Happy Halloween. You can see that I put my chair strategically located between the wrathful deity on my right and the Buddha on my left. The slight smell of pumpkin burning is the wrathful deity's flame. We'll call it righteousness or whatever those wrathful deities operate on. And so we have the light of our attention to focus on tonight's talk, if we could. So tonight we begin the action phase of the Eightfold Path. We have completed the wisdom phase. Now, how does that wisdom engage the body in speech and action and livelihood? That's the question we want to hold in our hearts. And it's interesting how much attention the Buddha gave to this particular phase of the Eightfold Path and how much time he spent speaking about wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. It always concerned me a little bit when I was new in the practice, how he would over and over again talk about lying or harsh speech or exaggerated speech, etc. And I thought, why is he so concerned with these types of speech, you know, what with divisive speech and wholesome conduct? And if we spend too much time focusing in on that area, isn't that just trying to be good? Aren't we just trying to be good people? But not if you understand the first two and three steps of the Eightfold Path, that this is about how we create artificial boundaries between ourselves and other people, and how then we encourage and elaborate and embellish those boundaries, making them more real and more substantial in our speech, action, and livelihood. And that unless we address how boundaries are formed through our action, we're really never going to get firmly in the direction of what the teaching is really about, which is the release of boundary formation and to stop inducing artificial boundaries through our activity. And that artificial boundaries are the majority of us, that's how we operate day after day, through our gossiping, through our backbiting, through our opinionation, through our harsh and derisive speech. And that we need to really look at this particular component of our activity and to bring it in alignment with this clear view of interconnection. Now, it's important at this point for me to say up front that the speech has to flow from wise view. We cannot cherry pick the Buddha's teaching. And I hear too often people saying, oh, you know, my speech needs a little bit of shoring up, so I'm going to practice wise speech this week. As if you could just kind of take that particular fruit off the Eightfold Path tree and expect it to stand by itself. It doesn't stand by itself. That it stands upon the first, in particular, the first and second steps of the Eightfold Path. And that unless we hold in our heart the certainty of connectedness, of interconnection, then when we do practice, unless we hold that in our heart, when we do practice wise speech, it will be just trying to be good. It'll be just trying to shore up our speech and be a little better at being in our articulation. But it won't really be in the spirit of where this whole thing is pointing. And the spirit of where this whole thing is pointing is to release the boundary between ourselves and other, which is often encouraged and exaggerated through our speech. I mean, let's not forget that thought is an inward speech. And if you look in the morning at the first word that rises and the one that continues throughout the day predominantly, it's this thought of I. Now, is that wise speech? When we start looking at our own internal monologuing in relationship to the context of where the Buddha is pointing in terms of interconnection, we see that we don't have to go or journey very far before we trip. And we trip on that certainty of the sense of me. Once we have that certainty of me, which is almost a given in our thinking and therefore in our speech, because speech is formed, comes into fruition, comes into form, manifests itself through thought. And unless our thought is in the right alignment, which is what I will be talking about in the next two talks around this topic, is how the words we choose hold the very view we hold, the view we assert, and the questions we ask of the world, especially in terms of our spiritual orientation, already can confine us to a kind of knotted space where we don't have the freedom really to explore because the questions aren't asked in a way that allows that exploration. The assumption of the question holds us in confinement. And so I'll talk about that in the next couple of weeks. But this talk tonight is just a brushstroke, a broad brushstroke on what most people think Buddha means by wise speech, although I think it's much more subtle than what we give it credit for. You see, how are we holding the world in any given moment? What are the assumptions that we are looking out and seeing and perceiving from these senses? And then how is our speech and action formed around those assumptions? And if those assumptions have such certainty to them, then our speech is going to hold the certainty of those assumptions. They have to. And sure, you can look at your lying behavior or your distorting behavior or your gossiping behavior or whatever form of distorting speech you would like, and you can hold yourself in abeyance. But those opinions, those views will continue to form. You just won't say them. And somehow in that righteous activity, we can pronounce how good we are to ourselves. That doesn't really have anything to do with what we're looking at here. It's the release of the need to make those assumptions is really what we're looking at, and how the words we use in speech keep reforming those very assumptions we're trying to understand and to penetrate. And speech certainly is the first manifestation of ourselves where the world can see, where our wisdom can be seen, isn't it? In our speech. It sets the posture for the rest of our life, our speech. And all actions flow from that sense. And so, if our thoughts are out of alignment, or any aspect of this, of how our speech comes into formation, but that we're going to practice wise livelihood, even though we speak in a gossiping or derisive manner, well, then it's a little bit like driving with two wheels out of alignment. And your car just doesn't go in the direction it needs to go. And this thing is a total drive. All the wheels have to be in exact alignment for this practice to work. So we have the view where we abide in our basic assumption. When we clear away all the debris and all of the spiritual orientation, and when we just look at what we really believe about our life, that's the view we hold of it. Mm-hmm. And then our intentions slip forth from that particular view. And then after the intentions, which is the basic arousal or direction that we're moving in relationship to the view that we hold of the world, then the thoughts begin to proliferate out from that particular intentionality. And once the thoughts proliferate out, so do the actions of body and speech. So thought then needs to really be owned. We need to take responsibility for the thought, for the inward speech, and not just let it be something that no one else can see, and therefore we can pretend like we're not having these particular distorted views within our thinking. And the I thought, again, I just want to reinforce this sense of I thought. And from time to time, to really look at where this I, this sense of I, this placement that has a functionality in speech. When we talk about I, it has a functional purpose. It's a convenience. But does it have to represent something that is beyond just an expression? When it starts representing something, when it starts assuring a placeholder in something, a fixed entity, we really need to start looking at that and just holding the question whether it is as certain of an assumption as I take it to be. Is this certain? Is it certain when I say I? Is that a certainty? Or is it a matter of convenience? A matter of ease for descriptive purposes. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about unwise speech, if I could, knowing that when we find ourselves in unwise speech, it's a cue for us to know that our thinking has the back two wheels of our car are out of alignment because the view is skewed as well as our intentionality. And therefore the thinking is going to be off kilt as well then as the actions of speech and body. So it's a cue for us that something's out of alignment. It's like, you know, having a shutter in your steering wheel. Something's out of alignment here. So let's just look at some of the normal ways that we distort our patterns of interactive communication. One of those is in exaggeration, right? And that's pretty universal. I don't think there are very many of us in here who never exaggerate. And so we ask from time to time, when we catch the cue, the sense that something is out of alignment, the way a spiritually adept person handles that is not by self-judgment, not through self-judgment, not trying to scold himself back into alignment or herself back into alignment, but rather to see what it is that's motivating, what's the intentionality, what am I doing, where is it basically out of alignment, what's the view I'm holding right now. And often we find it needs of some kind of sense of self-protection. And exaggeration is usually used to encourage more self-importance. If the larger my story, the bigger my fish story, the more you'll think of me and the relating of that story. And so I want to catch the pain of how I need you to relate to me in a more grandiose way than I am manifesting. I need to catch the pain of my sense of being small, of my feeling little, and why I have to speak in exaggerated terms in order for you to weigh in on my worth. And I think it's often unnoticed, that particular quality is often unnoticed. And when we catch that, can we feel that? Can we feel that sense? Can we catch the motivation? Can we catch where the vibration of the car is manifesting, that sense of the need, where the need for exaggeration comes from, which is the homework for this week. So that's one form of distorted speech. Another that is often used is lying, just not telling the truth. Now, I've told this story many times, but I think it's worth telling again because it holds a point. That when I was early in my training, I kept a lie notebook, which I very meticulously marked down those times when I lied so that I could count how good I was doing from one day to the next as I counted the little marks that I made every time I lied and then compared them over time to see how I was doing. And I wasn't doing very well. I remember there was, it definitely was not a graph up. If anything, it was flat or down. And so I was doing this because I felt that I needed to catch myself when I was lying. And there was no relaxation around that particular activity. There was just enormous sense of self-judgment. And when there is that kind of tension, you can be sure that the behavior is going to continue. When we have that kind of divisive, internal divisiveness in ourselves, you can be sure that the behavior will continue because of the angst that we are giving that very thing itself, that very behavior. And so you begin to back away from the need to plot the course of your own salvation or count the number of mistakes you make throughout the day. You don't need to do that. And so throw away the lie notebooks. Throw away the graphs. Throw away the counting of your mistakes and relax with them. The only way we're ever going to learn, which is the only way through this thing, is by owning the experience as it's manifesting rather than tightening around it with a sense of self-contraction. But as we're speaking a mistruth or a distorted truth, we're right in the middle of that behavior, feeling the pain that is driving that behavior, not denying any of that, and exploring what it is that I really want from you as to why I'm lying to you, why I'm distorting the truth, and seeing that how, when I do that, I am putting you very far distant from me. I'm separating you from me almost in infinite terms, infinite lengths. And that there's something inherently hurtful and harmful to myself and to the other when I do that. And I feel it in me. I feel what that feels like to cut myself off from you, especially when I distort the truth. And you can feel the pain of separation in that moment. You can feel the pain of being isolated within your own fiction, which is the lie we tell. Because what we're trying to do is impart our own fiction to another person so that they'll take it as truth. The Buddha said something interesting. He said, "For the person who transgresses in one thing, I tell you, there is no evil deed that that person will not do. What is that one thing? Telling a deliberate lie." If we are so governed, if we are so out of control that telling deliberate lie, there is essentially no, what's his words? There is no transgression that one, that the person won't commit. And I imagine that holds the whole spectrum from stealing to murder. Because if you think about it, you know, when you are willing to distort the truth a little, it's not so much, there's not so much, you keep, it encourages you to continue to flex that muscle again and again, to continue the distortion and even encourage greater distortions. And they're all being rationalized within ourselves as to why it's okay to do that. And once we tune ourselves to our own internal lie, which is our rationalization, as to why it's necessary for me to live in this manner, then it just keeps feeding upon itself and giving itself more and more strength. It becomes a habit, a way that we are with other people. And it becomes a mechanism for a power or manipulation over other people. And once we go down that road, it's very difficult because our character starts forming around that thinking, around the rationalization, around that particular behavior, and then manifesting itself again and again so that it becomes thicker and thicker and more conditioned behavior. Until virtually there is very little that we wouldn't be willing to do in the name of keeping our image safe. And so you can see where the Buddha is coming from this one activity of distortion and separation. And it's from the fear of being seen. If you look at really what the base root cause of lying is, never mind that the view from which we lie is one of a very distorted sense of me and you. But it's also, if you look deeply within that unwise view, we will find that we're afraid of other people seeing us the way we perceive ourselves to be. And therefore we keep conjuring up a story that allows them to see me differently than I know myself to be. And so the more I invest in that, the more I invest in the lie, the more I have to invest in that image. And the more people then relate to me from the image of that lie, the more I am destined to continue to lie. And it can be used for domination and control. I mean, all of us have felt that. It's when you're really fine-tuned in yourself and what wise speech is, there's a feeling, you can feel it in another person when they're distorting the truth. You feel it. And though we may be unwilling at that point to point that out, we still know that I need to put some distance between myself and this person. It doesn't feel right to us. And that sense of inward rationalization really must be owned. That sense of needing to protect ourselves from the truth of what we've done by creating continual self-denial about our motives, about the reasons, because you feel it in your heart when you do that. The dismissal behavior, the negating behavior. So this sense of distorting truth, the sense of exaggerating truth are two very, very important cues for us to know that our view is way out of alignment. And if you move to the deepest intentionality of yourself, your deepest sense of self-alignment is with your intentionality, as I've mentioned in other talks, then if you listen to that, which is a big if when your image is at stake, you'll find a self-correcting behavior there. In the alignment of wise view through that intentionality, through delving deeply into that intentionality. You just don't want to, why do we want to spend the rest of our life doing this? What do we gain from that? And the only thing you really gain is somebody else's idea of you. And what's that to you? It's virtually nothing. How somebody thinks of you doesn't affect really, it doesn't affect the marrow of your own system at all. It's just an idea of what they're thinking about you. So you're not getting really anything out of it at all. In fact, they probably know you're lying and aren't thinking what you're thinking they think at all. Okay, so we'll move on now to harsh speech. See, we're just looking at some of the different ways that we hold life and treat life with that hardness of speech, harsh speech. You know, that. So what is that harsh speech when we're too blunt or we're full of words that are harsh and biting? Well, that hardness of heart, you know, so you can feel it in the tone of the speech itself, that it doesn't invite kindness. It doesn't invite coming together. It doesn't invite the meeting, the relationship. It doesn't invite relationship is what it doesn't invite. It doesn't invite meeting in that relationship. And therefore, it doesn't invite sensitivity. It doesn't invite a way of looking. It doesn't invite gentleness, a gentle seeing, kindness and fluidity of mind. And that's really what the practice takes us. The practice takes us to more subtlety, to more sensitivity, to more open-heartedness, to more of an invitation to meet the other person. And so you begin to see that harsh speech, by its very nature, creates this divisiveness through the tone, through the implication. And so then we, okay, well, you know, some of it is, I, for one, am often accused, and rightly so, of being a little too blunt. And but the bluntness really doesn't, it's a more character formation than how I see the world. So it's not as if everything has to be all smooth and nice and gentle and kind of powder puffer, you know, it's like, you know, where you never, it's not like that. It's just how you're holding the world as you're speaking. And often, sometimes it can be an indication of the energetic force behind those words. And that energy can be misread by many people and often is. It can be misread as arrogance, or it can be misread as righteousness, or it could be misread in many different things. And it can be coming from the person in terms of a passion, in terms of something that's very important to say. And yet, from the outside, it can be misread. So it's not that we're always going to be able to see this, but in ourselves, how does it feel when we are harsh in our speech? How does it feel when you are too blunt, too rude, when the words aren't friendly or inviting? How does it feel? Okay, so harsh speech. Now let's move to gossiping, right? Like these. So what's happening in gossiping? It's very interesting. I have a friend. This was years ago, a good friend who's also a teacher now, and I had a very nice relationship, very congenial relationship with this person, and then someone else who knew both of us told me something about her that I, to this day, have not been able to let go of, and it's changed my relationship to her completely. And it was just a gossiping comment. And yet it completely transformed the way I relate to that person because of the nature of what was said. Never needed to be said to me, and it was just, I don't even know if it's true or was true, but what we say about other people can have an effect on how we perceive that person, even if we have not perceived that particular activity or behavior ourselves. And so when you begin to see that relationships can be held in a very distorting way through what we impart to each other about what we know of that person, why are we doing that? You know, what's the self-importance that we get through gossip? It's interesting to look at that. We, on our street, a woman just recently died of pancreatic cancer. And I was speaking with her husband, the husband of the woman who has died, and I said, you know, I don't want to tell the neighbors. I don't want to get into that. If you would like to tell the neighbors, you tell the neighbors, because I just don't want to get into let me be the first to tell you kind of thing. And he said, no, go ahead. So I didn't, because I just don't want to do that. But I just watched how, what the neighbors telling me, watched how they came to me and started talking to me, as if they were, you know, they had something very, very important they could tell me, you know, that I would be the, they would be the first to tell me, as if that was some revelation or something of self-importance for them to do, about somebody who had died, for God's sake, on the street. What is then that? What's the charge that we get, you know, when we communicate this secret, when we communicate this incident, this occurrence, as the, I don't know. I do know this, though, that someone talked about wise speech, unwise speech is like if you're up on top of Mount Rainier, let's say, and you take a feather pillow and you cut it open and you just disperse all the feathers in the wind and let them blow across the landscape for as many miles as they're carried. That's what unwise speech is like, when it's not responsibly done, when speech is irresponsible. You can't bring it back. You can't go pick up all the feathers. It just covers the landscape. And the treachery and the ill effect of what each of those feathers carry, potentially, can be as devastating as anything that we do in life. And you begin to really take some responsibility for the speech we have. And because you begin to understand, I mean, I know all of us have had the experience of overhearing something about ourselves when somebody's, you know, somebody didn't, would never say that to your face, but you overhear it. And then you can't reel that back in. Or that we have been overheard speaking to somebody and they overhear it. You see, it's interesting to me to look at why we speak at all. You know, we go down once in a while. I do a retreat down at Mount Madonna in California, and there's this Mooney, somebody who doesn't speak there for, and I think he hasn't spoken for, I don't know, like 40 years or something. He just writes on a little chalkboard. I don't know what led him to make that. You know, at some point he said, you know, that's it. No more. Why do we speak? Why do we speak? One, you know, it's interesting after a retreat, I give the people an opportunity before the retreat is formally over to often speak together. And then we come back and I say, now where did that speech come from? Because after a retreat, there is a very open, communicative, warm-hearted feeling between the people. And when the speech starts, it's often communicated from that warm-heartedness, from just a sense of mutual warmth, of sharing. That's just that beautiful commonality and relationship that you can find in speech that's aligned with the warmth of the heart. What the Buddha said, he said, speak only the speech that neither torments self nor does harm to others. And yet, as that speech, depending upon how long the people at the end of the retreat speak, there'll come a point when it quite likely will become self-affirming speech rather than warm-hearted speech. When the speech turns to how the experiences they had on their retreat and the meaning and depth of their practice, you know, or some way that they're beginning to form themselves around the speech that they do, where they lose that sense of warm-hearted connection and deliberately delineate themselves, make themselves distinct within their speech. So that this is not wrong behavior. It just needs observation. It needs, because At that point, we have calcified around the sense of I. And unless we're very careful, that sense of I will just keep growing proportional to the way we feed it. And so we just need to get a sense when we start feeling that sense of isolation and the need to affirm from that sense of isolation, from that sense of loneliness, from that sense of being separate from. Now sometimes people speak because they're afraid to be quiet. I have had any number of ceaseless conversations with people sitting next to me in an airplane across country, and the person just feels the need to speak the whole time. And it's about the hardest thing I can do to not just, let's say, okay, let's just take 20 minutes and be quiet together. That's not appropriate. So on and on it goes. And they'll tell me all up and down the scales of their life. They'll just, you know, so by the time after 4 or 5 hours of plane flight, I will have virtually know everything about them. And I will have said almost nothing. But it won't be easy. And sometimes we just feel that sense of emptiness, you know, where we're sitting beside somebody or you're together with somebody you don't know and there's that uneasy feeling. That uneasy feeling, what is that? See, I love that feeling of uneasiness. What is that? What's going on in that moment? It's a great place to examine. What is it? What is crying out for me from that unease? Is it like, oh, you know, they'll think I have nothing to say if I just remain quiet. So therefore, I'll say anything in order for them to think I have something to say, even though what comes out of my mouth isn't worth saying. Doesn't matter. Or is it just that I project that they project a certain feeling of my resonance or my, I don't know, you see. What is it? What is it that we're looking at in that moment of uneasiness? And you also know when somebody's very easy with their silence, don't you? When they're not disturbed by being quiet at all, and they're sitting next to you in the car, and there's no need to speak whatsoever, and you may not even know them. And there's that play, that easy play of speech or non-speech, you know, that it's not forced either way. It's just that the ease of being together. Oftentimes our speech is a product of our emotions at the time. And because our emotions, we can't contain them, we can't hold them in ourselves, we need to speak about them to other people. And we need to speak it when we tie them into our story. And we just, it's like an eruption of a volcano. And it's just because of the emotion that we might be feeling at that moment. Why? Because we can't hold an emotion. But none of this, I mean, sharing emotions, it's not to say that speaking from an emotion is wrong. It's just, there's an appropriateness and also appropriate time when we hold the emotion, and an appropriate time when we share the emotion with someone who's genuinely interested. We don't hold back in some kind of self-contained way and not share anything. That's not wise speech, and neither is it to sort of flood ourselves out into the, you know, into anyone's ear. And so there's a kind of appropriateness. There's just an appropriateness to speech that you can get a feeling for. We can get a feeling for with one another. And just having that play of lightness in it. We're not trying to protect anything. We're not trying to hold anything back so that you don't know that I'm grieving or that I'm upset or something. That's not a problem. So it's the ease, that ease of speech, where we're not so interested in controlling ourselves or being unemotional, which you can get into in this particular line of business, because people think that if you express an emotion, somehow you're not equanimous or something. I don't know. It's just all ridiculous, really. Just being human together is what the point of this practice is. And yet so much of our speech can be around the need to control through our judgment, through our evaluation, comparison, all of that. Two good friends of mine, one of whom was dying of leukemia and has since died of leukemia, the three of us were meeting together. We've been childhood friends. I knew these two people for 40 years. And they were... one was an FBI agent, the other was an airline pilot, and they're very conservative Republicans. So this was about 10 or so years ago. So I was visiting my sick friend in Portland, and my other friend flew in. And the two of them, when they got together, were so cynical about, I don't know, it sounds like a talk show host, you know. And I said, you know, John, who's the sick friend, I said, John, you know, I don't know how much time you have, and I hope you live a long time. But no matter how long you live, is this how you want to live? You want to live in this kind of kind of contracted way, cynical? And then whenever it is that you will die of this leukemia, if you do, do you want to die that way? And it's like a light bulb went on. Off. He said, no, I do not want that. See, when we really look at it, we don't want that. Even those of us who have cast a particular momentum into our bitterness, if we ever looked at it in terms of, is this the way we want our life? Is this the groove we want our life to follow? We'd say, no, this isn't it. I don't want to do this. But most of us, we don't have the courage to pull ourselves out and ask that question in the midst of the conversation. I find it difficult anymore to listen to any of that kind of... I mean, turn on your... We're a week from election. Turn on your television. I just turn it off. I can't listen to it. Whether it's for the candidate I appreciate or against the candidate I appreciate. It's the tone of the talk. And you turn to the talk show host. Whether they're liberal talk show hosts or conservative talk show, I can't listen to either one of them. Because it's the tone. It's the tone of separation. And when your mind and your heart really wants integration, really wants interconnection, it doesn't matter whether it's coming from the view that you particular, that you might hold. It's the conversation, it's the tone. I can't do this anymore. I don't want that anymore. So you begin to see that we have to give up views and opinions here. That the views and opinions that we hold become the very means on one around which our speech festers. And our righteousness coalesces. You know, we're speaking about the heart here. We're speaking about the heart. We're speaking about integration. We're speaking about wise view, from wise view. And that willingness, as the Buddha said, speak from a friendly heart. Speak from a friendly heart. In fact, he gave us criteria for a friendly heart, for speaking. It's interesting. It's not, as in most of these texts, it's not worded real well, but listen to it. In the case of words that the Buddha knows to be unfactual, untrue, unbeneficial, and unfriendly to others, he does not say them. Fair enough. They're not the fact. None of us would, probably, right? But keep listening. In the case of words that the Buddha knows to be fact, true, but unbeneficial, and unfriendly, he doesn't say them. He doesn't go to somebody and say, "God, you look like you've gained weight." Why? Because it's not beneficial. The person can't hear it. It's not friendly. It's not inviting. It's not of a friendly heart. But he goes on. In the case of words that the Buddha knows to be factual, true, beneficial, but unfriendly to others, he says, "I will wait for the appropriate time to say this." So if it's not useful to say it, if the person isn't receptive, if the person isn't open to hearing it, then even if it's beneficial to say it to them at some point, and it's factually true, he won't say it until it's the right time to say it. So we don't base our communication just on the fact that something is true, because there's no heart in that. There's truth in that. But if the truth isn't complemented, if wisdom isn't complemented with compassion, with love, then we are flying with a single wing. You see, it's not just saying what's true, and many of us get into that particular component where we're, you know, the truth above all else. Well, the truth be damned if it's hurtful. If nobody hears it, what's the point? If it doesn't invite communion, what's the point? In the case of words that the Buddha knows to be factual, true, unbeneficial, but friendly to others, he does not say that. It is only in the case of words that the Buddha knows to be factual, true, beneficial, endearing, and agreeable to others, then he will say them, because the Buddha has sympathy for all living beings. So that's a pretty good standard to judge our view of life and how we're holding life. If we consider the heart, the facts, if the words we use are factual, but if there's also a heart display, whether we're bringing things together, allowing things to come together through the words we use, we're inviting closeness, we're inviting non-separation, not further divisiveness, then we say them. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? As you sit, just notice how you coalesce around the eye. I just think that's just to become aware of that, not as a bad thing, but as a interesting way that we hold our experience around the kind of core assumption that we don't really test or even have much knowledge of, really. And that almost all of our activity and behavior comes from that basic assumption. And that basic assumption, when it is unexamined, can only lead to further division and further self-pronouncement. And so what if we just didn't give it that much validity? What if we just felt it, because it comes, but just didn't rally the troops supporting that assumption? We just let it come and let it go as it goes. Then our speech wouldn't necessarily follow the momentum of that conviction. And what you'll find when we start relaxing around that assumption is that our whole life opens up and our view opens up along with it. Okay, if there are any questions or comments from anyone, I'd be happy to respond if I can. Yes.
Thinking, I just picked up on just because of the
Don't own thinking. No, I know.
The thinking is not your culture.
Yes, good. Yes, good, good. No. Right. I certainly will. So the question is, my comment about owning our thinking, when I spend most of my time telling you to disown your thinking, which is a bit fair enough. Very good. It's what I, when I was talking about radical accountability, do you remember when I was talking about radical accountability? That when we're, when our thinking holds a kind of conviction, we need to take responsibility for what the conviction is that our thoughts are trying to assert, right? So, we take responsibility for that. We take responsibility for what our thoughts are telling us about the world. Now, as we get quieter, we begin to see that the thoughts aren't really communicating accurately that picture, the depiction of the world as it really is. But most of the time, we're very convinced that they do. And as long as we're convinced that they do, we have to take responsibility for that conviction and the movement and momentum that they give to our thoughts of speech of mind, right? Certainly the idea, the thought of I, carries a huge conviction and momentum with it. And at some point, you're going to be able to feel that sense of I without it being so assumed true. It takes a while, but it'll start seeping down over time. Then it's not necessary to do anything when it arises, except just let it be there. But as long as it has a momentum, we have to take responsibility for the drift, for where it's going. And wait a minute here. Let me question this. We have to interrupt it a little bit. So it's that radical accountability that I was speaking about earlier in terms of our emotions. Yes.
The last part when you were talking about the criteria.
Yes.
And I think sometimes I find myself in a conflict over whether I have chosen not to say something because I think the timing is not right.
Right.
Or because I'm hiding behind that because I don't have the courage.
Right. Yes, she
says
sometimes she doesn't realize whether she's not saying something because the timing isn't right or whether she lacks the courage to say it. And both may be true. It may not be one or the other. Oftentimes our motivation is mixed. And it's not so much to either one, you know, it's not so much to criticize ourselves no matter why we're not saying it, but to really get a sense for if there is a fear, you know, to really look at that, or if there is a just whether the moment, when the moment is right, it's not a big deal to say it. If it's a big deal to say it, quite likely the moment isn't right. You, in the right moment, when it's framed in the right way, so it's not just the right moment, but it's said friendly. It's framed in a way that invites your caring for the person through the communication. So that you're saying something from caring. You care about the person. You know, when you do this, this is what I always... I don't know how it's... I mean, each of us have our own way of saying it through our heart. But when it's said caringly, you know, it doesn't require a big build-up of... It's just because you really care. You want the person to know about this about themselves. You know, it's a little bit like... when somebody has a piece of food on their cheek, and you can say, you know, do I have the courage to tell them this? If you care about, if it's your wife, you'll tell them immediately, won't you? If it's somebody you don't really like too well, you may let them hang out there for a while. It says a lot. And if we don't have the courage, what is it that is missing there? Is it timing? Is it friendliness? Is it caring? Is it saying it in a way, finding the right words to invite the communication? Is it afraid that they'll be upset by what you're saying? And if they are and will be, then maybe it isn't the right time. Maybe it needs to be communicated. It doesn't mean, though, that whatever you say it, there won't be some reaction on the other person. There may be. And you do the best you can, and still the thing will fall apart in some way. You'll get a response or reaction that you didn't think. You just do the best you can on this. You don't wait until you think you have all A's on all the marks. You know, you just do the best you can. And just with your heart, leading with your heart and leading with caring, so that you feel the caring and you feel the wanting to communicate this for their advantage, not for your righteousness, then you just try to do it the best you can. And it takes practice, and I'm not very good at it, but I try to do it and learn each time so that I pick up the more intuitive side of it, that was the feeling right? Was I in right orientation to this experience? And because you can often see that when you deliver it, as to whether the intuition was right or not. That's really where the learning takes place. It's fun, you know. It's not a lie notebook, you know. It's an art, not a science. It's doing the best you can. That's all. Yes.
As we're looking at and questioning the assumptions around I.
Yes.
Where do you go?
Yes.
I see the temptation to go say the I is, says your ABC. You question that.
Right.
No, I'm not. You go to the opposite.
Right.
So do you go to, I don't know, as you're kind of peeling away the layers?
If that's true for you. I mean, in this moment, what is your first name?
Denise.
Denise, in this moment, right? So let's let the energy fall away from your mind and the question. In this moment, as you're sitting there, what are you in this moment?
I can't.
That's right. That's exactly right. You see, that's where you go. You don't have to go any further than that. And when we try, you see, it's not as if there's an answer to who I am. There's just a vagueness of not knowing. There's like it's not knowing. When you really look, when you really quiet and say, who am I in this moment? You see, it's not obvious. You see, that's all. That's all we're suggesting, is to let yourself be less obvious than what you think, take yourself to be. And it only takes a moment of just being quiet. And you'll find it's really perplexing. I mean, my words hold this assumption so firmly, and yet when I'm just quiet a little bit, what's back there as the posture for that assumption isn't really that convincing. What holds that assumption? So I think we make a mistake. First of all, we make two mistakes. We make a mistake to try to find our no self. And that's just finding a sense of self called no self. So that's not right. The other one is that we're going to banish the sense of self from our language and from our feelings, so that we'll never have an ego. Okay, well, that's ridiculous, because it has a function. It's like words have a function. It's like sitting down and saying, okay, I'm never going to speak again. That's it. Well, it's kind of stupid for most of us, because they're functional. So is egoically, it has a function. But it's not what we have conceived it to be in terms of the assumption about me. And so from time to time, just let it be vague. Right? Now, you can only do that if you're not in too much pain. When there's a lot of background pain, then the pain calls for a firmer sense of yourself, a shored up sense of yourself, so that your boundaries are in place and your power is in place and all of the ways that we've given ourselves. And so for many people, they have to work on their pain issues before they can ask that question legitimately. But even for all of us, none of us are in pain all the time. And for any one of us, we can just from time to time say, well, you know, if I really ask myself, what am I in this moment? It's not so clear cut. That's all. Just let that be enough. This is not so clear cut. Can't you feel that? See, there you are. Yes. More safe, yes, that's good.
So
that's very good.
The difficulty that I've always had in communicating with the inside me versus the outside, is that it's just kind of a lack of trust or
yes.
myself.
And
yes. A million reasons growing up here, getting down.
Yeah.
But I'm noticing that it just feels the more I'm doing this practice, the more.
Yes, no, that's the way it should go.
And then it just seems that it's easier to talk.
Yes, from that sense of safety.
But it seems to be coming from a sense of just feeling more safe.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Good. She says as she does more practice, she has a growing sense of safety in herself, which allows an ease of communication and a relaxed need of fear and mistrust and all of those. So for you, the word is safety. And when you have a word like that, you use it because it's obvious that early in your life, that word wasn't there or you wouldn't be, that wouldn't be such an important word for you. For some people, it's groundedness. For some people, it's just embodiment, you know. And so as the practice goes, we do have a more sense of embodiment, a more sense of groundedness, more sense of, you know, of just of not disowning ourselves for the world's response to us. Right? And so it doesn't matter too much to me. And see, this isn't a distancing. This is not caring. Many people, well, yeah, I don't care what you think, so that's it. No, that's not it. It's genuinely knowing that whatever the person is thinking about you need not matter to you at all. In fact, if it does, it throws your sense of safety off kilter. And so when the safety issue is so important to you, that above all else will take you to your authentic being. Because it's only in your authentic being that you will feel safe. Not in your pretentiousness. Not the way you give yourself away. Right? So that's your honing device. And say, okay, and when you feel unsafe for whatever reason, you know, you just hold that. You say, what is there in this moment that's unsafe for me? You look around, and often it's a projected feeling of what somebody's thinking about you. And you think, I don't need to be unsafe in that. So much of our early childhood experience, the unsafety was because of lack of strength, because the world was bigger than we were, and that physically we were unsafe. But now, as adults, it has been bred into our psychological representation of the world. Even though we're empowered to be an adult, psychologically we're still small children. And so you just look around and you start challenging the need to feel unsafe. Because really, this moment, where in this moment are you unsafe? And I'm not talking about physically going down into some seedy part of town and pretending to be, you know, not that. I'm talking about right now, right here. So most of our moments coming from this kind of relative ease, we can question that. And you'll just find yourself shoring up and then expanding out. Because when you're safe, you can flow out. You have attention to give others. When you're unsafe, you're cocooned within yourself. And as your attention starts flowing out, the sense of interconnection starts flowing out with that attention. With your assurance that you can say no to somebody, if knows what you mean. Practice it, you see? You start practicing all these different ways that you feel inhibited, and you begin to take own your own empowerment. When you feel your own empowerment, then, in that safety of being able to say no or yes equally, then your caring will move out beyond yourself. So good, yeah. So take that, yeah, very nice. Take that. Okay, so we have to stop for the evening. Thank you all very much. Please practice your homework, and then we'll have a discussion next week around this particular topic.